So this is for posterity. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Homage to the Buddha, the Blessed, Noble, and Fully Self-Enlightened One. So this is just an opportunity really for most of us just to revise the principles of our meditation, of our practice, and to introduce people to it. So I've got to tread a sort of middle path here. So if boredom arises, note boredom. There came a time when I was, listening to teachers, my teachers, when they started off on the Four Noble Truths, I felt like throttling them. So resist that temptation, please. I think our problem is really that we complicate the practice. It's what the Buddha discovered is essentially extremely simple, and this comes out in a lovely story of a monk who is very dull-minded, intellectually challenged, shall we say. And every time, in those days, remember, there's no iPods or anything like that. You had to remember the teachings. And so what he said was that when he learnt a new phrase from the Buddha's teaching, it knocked the one he'd just learned out of his mind. So his brother said to him, who was a monk, that, you know, really he wasn't up to it and he ought to do something more useful with his life. But when the Buddha heard this, he came to see him and said, and gave him very simple practice. He just took his cloth, a piece of cloth, and he said, just hold it, wipe your face with it, rub it, and as you're doing that and keep looking at it, just keep saying impermanent, impermanent, transient, transient, change, change. And in no length of time, he became fully liberated. Now, I've tried it. The Buddha had an in to people's minds, you see. So we're a bit unfortunate he's not around. But that shows us how essentially simple the practice is, you see. And the Buddha himself begins his search at the point where he becomes at the point where he realizes that the pleasures of the life he's leading are empty in themselves. This is an important point. So there's two parts of his awakening, or we might say, which led to his, what we would call these days, his existential crisis at the age of 29. The first was this scene where they've just had a party, and he wakes up in the morning just to see these bodies around him disheveled in disgusting positions and all that sort of stuff. And what he's catching there is the other side of the pleasure syndrome. In a more obvious way, whenever you enjoy something while you're enjoying it, well, it's heaven. There's no problem with it at all. It's when it comes to an end. You see, then there's the desire for, let's do it again, see. And the doing it again never quite lives up to the first, for the first doing. Then there's the grief, of course, if you lose something which you treasure, whether it's an object or a person. There's the frustration when you can't get what you want. And there's the anxiety of losing it. Hence our huge insurance industry. All these, this is the aftermath of some relationship we have with the pleasures and joys of life. And began to feel that, you see. And this added to the fact that all life comes to an end. For human beings, for all sentient beings. At least up until this present moment. One lives in hope, you know. And this is told with the myth where he sees a sick person, an old person, and a corpse, and an ascetic sitting under a tree. And each time, because he's been guarded from this, or we can say these days that he became aware of the fact that bodies grow sick, they grow old, they die. And it hit him, you see. The question was, does this happen to me? So there's your fundamental problem, you know, this business that all life comes to an end. And seeing this ascetic under a tree raised a certain hope that there was an end to this sort of suffering. In those days, as these days, they believe Easterners are much more easy with the idea of rebirth. So you can understand that this was horrific to many people in those days when they thought that they would have to be reborn again to grow old, to die, to be born again, to grow old, to die, to be born again. So the future looked pretty bleak. So he goes away from his home. He leaves home at a crucial point where his child is just born, driven by this inner pain, this existential crisis. Now, what he's leaving is, or what he's given up on, is the pleasures of ordinary daily life. That's what he's given up on. Now, the first two teachers that he comes across teaches him how to establish beautiful states of mind within himself, eventually without any need for anything outside. So this afternoon we'll be practicing metta, the practice of goodwill. And it's a sort of mantra practice. And just by repeating this word and having the intention of offering people goodwill, the heart rises and slowly you can develop this inner bliss, this inner ecstasy. And of course you don't need anything, you know. You don't even need tea. You just, all you need is a place to sit, clothes to keep warm, and you're away, you're in this blissful state. But this also suffered from this quality of impermanence. These blissful states also came to an end, and it was just sad old depressed Siddhartha Gautama. Again. So he sort of abandons that and then he goes into these ascetic practices. The idea that desire was the cause of suffering is already there within the Rig Veda and the early Upanishads, the ideas around the Buddha at the time. But the understanding was that desires were driven by the body. So you wouldn't have greed if you didn't feel hungry. As simple as that. So you stop feeling hungry, you don't eat. So he stopped eating, and he says at one point he could hold his spine through his stomach. And he went through other various ascetic practices, and what he discovered was it was just more suffering. He just didn't really get anything out of it. And he leaves his companions, who think he's gone soft, and won't talk to him. So he's sitting by the roadside, feeling quite dejected, and you know, wondering what to do, presumably, because in a sense he's received all the teachings of his time, so it's a point of despair, you see. And that's why we say he's self-enlightened, by the way, because everything that the time had to offer him didn't lead to the end of suffering, which is what he was seeking, you see. So along comes this a woman with rice pudding, or at least a rice cake, and going to offer it to a local god under a tree, it seems. But seeing this poor wretch, decides that, you know, he probably needs it more than this god. And we all know the salvific value of rice pudding. So he takes this pudding and it sort of revives him. But it's something happens there to connect him with a childhood experience. There's no explanation really in the scriptures as to why he should have remembered that then, or at that time, or around that time. But he remembers watching his father doing a ploughing ceremony. And it's the manner in which he's watching which arouses in him an idea which drives him to which encourages him to have a real last go at trying to find, trying to solve his personal problem. And what he remembers are all the things that we've been practicing now, you see. So remember, there are these seven factors of enlightenment. The first one, awareness, is a specific type of awareness. It's not just, I mean, a bank robber's aware, but hardly moving towards liberation. It's an awareness which has to be attached to the rest of the seven factors. And there are three passive factors, and this is what we were practicing this morning. It's the calmness, see? Stilling the body, keeping it still, calming the heart, stilling the mind. So there has to be some form of calmness to begin with, you see. And then there's this, it's translated as concentration, but whenever you say that word, it makes people very tight. But it's just stillness of attention, that's all. Just keeping your attention on an object. And we can do that easily if the object's exciting, like a film. I don't have any problem concentrating on a film. But on something which is neutral, like the rising and falling of the breath, I mean, I can't think of anything more boring, really. But for the fact that it's a neutral feeling, and you're keeping your attention on it, is building up a quality of attention in the mind, which is not dependent on something exciting. See? And so it becomes a quality within this awareness itself. I'm using awareness now to... I'm trying to keep off the word consciousness. The knowing, shall we say. This faculty we have which knows. And then the third quality is really extremely important. I've come to see it as I've never given the accent that it really deserves in my teaching, but these days I'm really stressing this fact of equanimity. Equanimity is that quality of being open, of receiving, of just receiving. And to do that, you have to drop your opinions, because your opinions filter things out. You have to let go of your emotional barriers. So it's a very sort of receptive position that you're taking, an openness to things. Coming from a position of don't know, or at least not sure. Yeah, there's a bit of conceit there, at least not sure. See? Even though we know that everything changes, are we sure that we've seen it at a level which will have a systemic effect on me? Which will actually change my relationship to the world? The Buddha's phrase is, to perceive impermanence at its deepest level means that we really understand that there's nothing in this world worth holding on to. Okay? There's nothing in this world worth holding on to. That's the effect of seeing impermanence. See? Now, see, that level's frightening. Yeah? It's frightening to actually perceive that there is actually nothing in this world worth holding on to. Now, I thought I was worth holding on to. It's difficult to realize that I'm not worth holding on to. So, opening up to that, we find that fear, you know, fear comes, like our attitude towards death, serious illness, etc. So those three qualities, see, the calmness, which you establish on the breath, because the breath is neutral, see? The sense of steadiness of attention, focus, just steadiness of attention, and that sort of openness, see? Those are your three basic qualities. And I'm suggesting that that's your default position. And you don't just do it when you're sitting, you do it throughout the day. Every time you finish a job, every time you've set yourself a task, even as simple as, say, washing the pots, when you come to a stop, see, fall back into that position. See, and it levels everything out. And there's great clarity there. Because you're open, you see. Then the next intention comes. Now, this intention in meditation, in our Vipassana practice specifically, is to observe these three characteristics. So then you have your next three qualities: effort, I mean, effort's already there in a sense, because it's part of the attentiveness. But here it joins with a certain curiosity, and that's really your motivation, the heart's motivation towards liberation. It's the quality of a philosopher. It's the wonder. I wonder. See? The question mark in the mind without an answer. So one now begins to investigate, and at first you can actually point the attention at one of these three characteristics. Whether it's the impermanence or the not self, not me, not mine, we'll come to that later. Or this, the more sort of obvious psychology of how we attach to things or resist things. And then once the interest is awakened, as it were, in those qualities, you can let go of everything. You can let go of all the instructions, you see. You don't have to look at anything specifically. It's as though this intelligence we have, this intuitive intelligence, is now primed to see these qualities. And that's what you're developing. You're developing an attitude. See? So that even when you go out into daily life and you might just be doing some shopping, suddenly you have little insights about things. Because the attention, because that intelligence has been primed to see things as impermanent, not me, not mine. And to see the suffering that's involved when we begin to form this relationship of wanting and not wanting, possessing, identifying with. And that's when you are completing the seven factors of enlightenment. We should translate that really as seven factors leading to enlightenment. You know, you don't get them when you're enlightened. You're supposed to be developing them on the way. Is the Dharma. You're actually investigating the Dharma, you see. That's what turns all these qualities, which are quite natural to us. Everybody's has awareness and effort, and occasionally they're calm. Yeah, everybody wants to know, whatever it is. All these qualities are within us, but what turns them towards this liberation, this investigation, which leads to liberation, is the investigation of these three characteristics, because that's where our delusion lies. That's the problem. So the mind is very clever. It creates continuity where there's actually discontinuity. See? So every morning you wake up and you look at your face in the mirror, you see, and you presume it's you. You presume it's the same face you went to bed with. Huh? But it definitely wasn't the one you were born with. But we don't see that, you know, like, that's gone. It's my face. It keeps being the same. I mean, what happened if you woke up one morning with somebody else's face in the mirror? It'd be, you know, you'd be calling for help. And to see that, it's in Buddhism, the quality of anicca, the quality of impermanence, is radical. Everything is arising and passing away. Passing away. That's why we watch the breath. The in-breath begins, it finishes, it's gone. That's the end of that in-breath. That's the end of that life moment. That's gone, finished. We start the out-breath, we see the beginning, it comes to an end. It's finished, complete. You'll never get that breath again. And it's really drumming that home, that every second, every moment is arising and passing away. And with that, you're contacting your fear of death. Everybody's always there with the rising. That's not a problem. You know who the next celebrity is. But you don't know what happens to them afterwards. They'll disappear. Nobody likes to see the ending of things, you know. And then there's this quality of not self. Now, this is where people tend to complicate things, because It turns into a sort of philosophy about the self. In later Buddhism, the great philosopher Nagarjuna, and this huge philosophy around duality and not self and all that, built up, you know, this massive. And of course, all the intellect does, it drives you to a point of it's a dead end. So fine, you get to the point where you realize that everything is empty. Is insubstantial, it doesn't have its own being, it's sentient. And that's an idea, so you've got to say that emptiness is also empty. The emptiness of emptiness. People write books about the emptiness of emptiness. what the hell is that? You just spent a couple of weeks knowing that emptiness is empty. Doesn't help, you see. You just end up thinking. But when you go back to the scriptures of the actual way the Buddha's teaching, it's nothing to do with metaphysics. It's an actual specific practice where you are experiencing something and you're distancing from it within yourself as an object. So there's pain in your knee. So there's that which knows and there's the pain. So there's two things there. And if it's an object to the knowing, how can it be the knowing? How can the object be the subject? You experience that as an object. It's out there, the pain in the knee. As soon as you do that, as soon as there is that separation, as soon as there is that, you're already there. It's not me, not mine. Doesn't mean it doesn't stop hurting. But what it happens is that there's no relationship with it of this not wanting it. Because you're not identifying with it, you're not possessing it. And that not wanting it is where your suffering lies. So the distinction is made between pain, which is natural to the body, and suffering, which is your relationship to it. Same with emotions. Emotions are much more easy for us to identify with. I am depressed. How do you get out of that? Where's the escape with that? I am depressed. That's it. Seek the bridge. And what do you do? I am anxious. There's no way out of that. But when you sit here and you can feel the heaviness of depression, feel the wobbliness, the nausea of anxiety, you're distancing from it. You're pulling yourself out of it. And in pulling yourself out of it, you're objectifying that feeling. In objectifying that feeling, you're finding a new relationship with it whereby you're not getting depressed about being depressed. About getting angry about being depressed about being depressed. And you get so angry about it that you begin to get very fearful that you're getting so angry about being depressed. And that's really depressing. And so it goes on and on. It's a sort of a spiral. But once you've pulled out, you see, where can this depression go? Where can these feelings of depression go? Where can these feelings of anxiety go? Where can they go? They can't go anywhere, can they? Because you've opened up to them, that's the equanimity, you're no longer suppressing them. They're no longer damaging the body. And because you're not allowing them, you're not identifying with them, which immediately creates a story. All you're left with is this energy, with these feelings. And what we discover is that they begin to exhaust themselves. You don't have to do anything. The heart will heal itself. And every time you identify with it, it manifests as thought patterns. And then you realize that these pesky emotions have been developing themselves through your imagination. And all you have to do is stop that. So you won't stop it if you think you're suppressing something. If you think if you're stopping a thought, you're going to suppress these emotions, then you won't do it. But when you realize that if you stop the thinking, stop the daydreaming and the fantasizing, that you're not suppressing anything, you're actually stopping an indulgence. You're actually stopping things getting worse. And then you realize that by coming back into the body, this is where the answer lies, in the body, and you feel the depression, and you're able to stay with it calmly, patiently. You feel the anxiety, and you're able to sit with it calmly, you see. And you turn that quality of investigation on it in its insubstantial nature. I mean, what's it made of? What is an emotion before you give a name to it? To catch the quality of impermanence about it. As soon as you do that, you realize that in fact you're letting it out, you're liberating it. And if you hang on long enough, it actually disappears. And then you say to yourself, fantastic, no more depression. Oh, fool. Now there's masses of it. For most, anyway. Yeah, a bit unfortunate. Unfortunately, this does take some time. You have to have a long-term view. Now, if you look at your meditation and you look back a week, well, you can't see any progress at all. Look back a year, you can sort of see, well, maybe. When you look back a few years, then you see there's movement, there's change, you see. So this transformation, and that's what's happening, by the way. These emotions, these negative stuff that we experience, that energy is not lost. It's transforming, and that's the practice this afternoon of metta. See, so all that hatred becomes love, the cruelty becomes compassion, the fear becomes peace. Actually, it's love. It's what transforms into love. So all those things are happening of themselves. You don't even have to do anything. The whole therapy, the whole psychotherapy in meditation is based on the ability to bear with what is arising and passing away. And the liberation is on how you bear with it, what it is that you're actually looking at when you experience these things. So you're looking at the quality of its impermanence. You're looking at the quality of its insubstantiality. What is it? What's it made of? See? Go into the texture of it. And you're looking at this relationship we have of wanting and not wanting, which manifests the original delusion, which is that we're seeking happiness in the sensual world. See, it won't deliver. We know that from this banking crisis. It just won't deliver. And once you give up that, you see, then you'll begin to search like the Buddha for where is this permanent happiness. So he talks of nirvana. So what does he mean? Where is it? But first of all, you have to leave the world to find it. You see? And the last thing I'd like to say is that nothing in this process is lost. Everything is transformed. The Buddha, because of his more negative approach to the teaching, not this, not that, was often accused of being an annihilationist. But he said the only thing that's annihilated is greed, hatred and delusion. See? So in practicing stopping the mind, the thinking, the imagining, you're not going to lose the quality of thought. Remember that after he was liberated, when he was awakened, he spent 40 years teaching. Talking all the time. Poor fella. He had to take breaks. Yeah, he had to go into the forest to be by himself. And they said to him, why, you know, now that you're liberated, why do you go off and meditate? He said, I do it for my own quiet abiding. Get away from these people. And I do it as a good example to others. But you'll notice that it's the quiet abiding that comes first. Even he had a limit, huh? Now, the skill of meditation, what you really also have to go into is how you deal with the various mental states that arise. And the Buddha talks about them as five hindrances. All those things to do with desire, you know, keep the mind into an excited state. All that area to do with anger and hatred and not wanting. All that you have to be able to deal with without being caught up in the thought patterns. And always the trick is to come off the mind and come back into the body and just experience these feelings as they manifest in the body. It's as simple as that. That's all. You don't have to do anything. When it comes to dullness and lethargy, your determination, you must refuse to be annihilated under all circumstance. Now, it's difficult on a day retreat and in ordinary life to distinguish between true tiredness and this lethargy and dullness that we suffer from. And to tell you the truth, I would say virtually everybody that comes on my retreats has some problem with sleep. Some either some sleep deprivation, they're not sleeping properly, or they're not sleeping enough, or they're oversleeping, which is actually how you develop dullness and lethargy. So don't be too rough with yourselves on being, you know, tired and dull and all that. But just try to stay awake with it and make those feelings, the dullness in the head. See, keep moving the attention around the head. And the heaviness of the body, keep moving the attention up and down the body. Just moving the attention will keep you awake within it. And again, you're investigating that quality of impermanence, insubstantiality, not me, not mine. See, you're always looking at it from this perspective, just driving home these understandings. When it comes to restlessness, refuse to move under all circumstances. Stay absolutely still. Even though the body wants to leap up, you remain steadfast at your post. See? And just keep your attention moving, you see? Keep it moving around the body so that it doesn't get caught up in that restlessness. And then finally, skeptical doubt. So this is an insidious mental state. I mean, it can run through your life if you suffer from it badly. You know, is this the job for me? Is it not? Is it? You can't make up your mind, you know? Should I be with this person? Should I not? Oh, goodness. And it just drives you potty, you see? And what skeptical doubt does is it stops you making a decision, stops you making a commitment, which is different from ordinary doubt, where, in a sense, you haven't got enough information and you're waiting for information to make a decision. But when you find yourself unable to make decisions, then there's something, you know, there's some fear there of consequences. I don't know, something is blocking just that making of a decision. Now, in the spiritual life, that just stops you practicing. So be careful of that. The fact that you're all here practicing means that you can't be suffering from it for that much. So these mental states, as they come up, you see, just recognize them and remind yourself. See, when you're in Vipassana meditation, don't go into this feeling that you can't think. You can always think about what you're doing. You can reflect on what you're doing and then go back into the insight process. So at the end of the sitting, when I said reflect on what you've just experienced, you can do that as you're sitting. So if the mind's going all over the place, so you just stop, relax, and say to yourself, what's going on? See? Right, okay, see. And then talk to yourself, you see. You are good, you can do it. You see? And then go, and then draw yourself back into the meditation. So you don't just keep allowing the mind to go wherever it wants. Actually stop and reflect on what's happening within you. At the end of the sitting, that's important. So if you haven't been very skillful, so you say to yourself, well, next time that happens, I'll do this. Don't confuse that with self-judgment, right? If these little phrases come up saying, I can't do it, I'm useless, or I'm brilliant, whatever. Just notice that those are self-judgings. That's not what you want. But you can definitely be critical, positively critical, about your own practice. See? And then you make a resolution. So if you see that, you've got into this habit of meditating every morning, and every morning you just fall asleep, and you think, well, that's no good, is it? So you have to make a resolution. Next morning I will not fall asleep in my meditation. See? And even if you fall asleep, that's fine. You just keep making that resolution, and eventually it does work through. So that's the process that we're in, you see. It's first of all establishing this basis of calmness, steadiness of attention, and openness. Right? We'll presume awareness is there. Yeah. And once that is there, we awaken the interest to observe these three characteristics. And as we are in the sitting posture, things come to draw us away, take us away on dreams and fantasies. So we have to note them and recognize them very clearly, and we bring ourselves back to the body. Sometimes when you come off a dream, as you come into the body, you can feel the anxiety or the excitement that's empowering it. So that's where you stay, you see. That's where you stay. That's it. I've come to the end. So if you'd like to do some walking meditation, just to stretch your legs. How are we doing for time? And if those of you who are new to the practice, if you stay behind it with any questions or clarifications. So if we begin, say, 25 minutes, if you... do the bell in 20 minutes. And then we'll sit again at 12:30. Lunch around 1:30, if you can hang on in there. Yeah? So those of you who are new, especially those of you who are new, please stay behind. And we can go over some of the stuff. Thank you.